So we're talking about the lifetimes of Rav Kook, and we mentioned that he was born in 1865, grows up in Lithuanian yeshivas. At 23, takes the position in this town in Lithuania. His wife dies. He marries a cousin of hers. And in 1895, he became the rabbi of another town. And then in 1904, he becomes the rabbi in Jaffa. Don't forget, Tel Aviv is founded shortly after that, so it's... But right now, a lot of Jews are living in Jaffa, and there are also a lot of agricultural settlements around there, so he's also the chief rabbi of those people, too. So he has to go and meet with these people, mostly non-religious kibbutzim, some religious kibbutzim, and he has to try to deal with them. He does, generally, he writes on mysticism, and his general thoughts, and his sort of flowing thoughts, but he also has many letters, a beautiful English collection of some selected letters by Rav Kook. Generally, he wrote the Orot HaKodesh, the Holy Lights. He wrote some about, and you can also get it in the this edition, the Western Classics, the what's it called, the Classics of Western Spirituality. They also put out an edition of it. There are some individual volumes in English, like the Lights of Return and other books. But he did also write in the Talmud. One of the Alon brothers once asked me if I would help with this project. So he gave me I never did much for it, but this is, Rav Kook did write about the Talmud, and particularly midrashic things about the Agadot of the Talmud. This is his famous Orot, Orot HaKodesh. There's some volumes of that. It's a classic edition. So there's Orot HaEmunah, Musar Avicha, Musar. Anyway, all kinds of Rav Kook books. Anyway, but it's important to note that he also commented on the Talmud as well, because he was a great scholarly rabbi. One of his positions was that they could have the, during the sabbatical year, like this year, they continue to use his leniency, that they could sell the land to the Gentiles. And he wrote a whole long treatise about it, and a very hefty work, you know, many 20-page volume, to defend this notion of selling land to the Gentiles under limited conditions, given that there were so few settlements and so few farms and such a small economy, and if they wouldn't sell it to Gentiles, they'd be in big trouble. So there's a debate today whether that leniency still applies with a multi-billion-dollar economy. But in any event, generally it's still used. And then then he gets stuck in Europe during World War I. So while he was there, he became the rabbi of the great synagogue there in Spitalfields there, and in Switzerland, and then eventually he comes back to Israel, and in 1921 he founds the Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav. He wanted to be like a center, like Mordechai Kaplan had the idea of the Jewish center, people had the idea of the Jewish communities, so he wanted his yeshiva to be like a center. We'll talk later about his vision of the yeshiva, and he eventually becomes the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, and that's how he's often known. There were always Sephardic chief rabbis from going back to about several hundred years, but there was never an Ashkenazic one. He was the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Palestine. Later there were chief rabbis, of course, of Israel. Eventually he dies in 1935, so ironically, or strangely, he, this great lover of Zion and a great supporter of the development of Israel, never saw the state of Israel, but he lived before. And they said, you know, 20,000 people came to his funeral. He was respected by people well beyond the small enclave at that time of the yeshiva people in Israel. And so this is what you can learn about him, Wikipedia, whatever, wherever. That's some of the story. But when he came out with his Orot HaKodesh, with these works, as we'll see, there are some radical ideas there. Now, we mentioned last week the school of the Sfas Emes, the Hasidic writer, the Sfas Emes, and that he came from a sort of a school that said, you know, let's not focus so much on mysticism, let's focus on the Nigla, on the Torah that we can understand and everyone can access. If we do mention Kabbalistic things, let's tell it in kind of an easy way. It's Sfat Emet, should be an easy tongue, a truthful tongue, we should be able to focus on, we should be able to hear it. Sfat Emet spent half of his life working on Talmudic works that were not mystical at all. So Sfat Emet came from his grandfather's school that was of Simcha Bunim, of Shischa, and this was a more rational school that was really trying to move away from the miracle worker type of Hasidus, and also moving away from some Hasidus which had some antinomian elements. What does that mean? It's that anti-legal, in other words, some elements that seem like, well, you know, the real essence of the mitzvah is to have joy. Well, that kind of takes away from the mitzvah itself. So Rav Kook, he seems to be attracted to the other kind of Hasidus that is very dreamy and mystical, and borders on, gets into some dangerous territory, which we'll explore as the evening goes on. So when he came out with the book Orot HaKodesh, the first volume, he was condemned. There was a big letter that came out from all the local rabbis. There were a few rabbis locally who supported him, but some big people, like Rav Sonnenfeld and others, were Rav Diskin, were dead against him, and said some very harsh things which he took offense to. So the Ger Rebbe happened to be in town. The son of the Sfas Emes came to town. They figured, who would be better to come than the son of the Sfas Emes, who after all would appreciate some of the mystical things he had said and all that. So what did he say? Page 3, on the right side. This is a letter he wrote on the boat on the way home from his trip to Israel. The Rav, the Gon, he gives him all the accolades. Rav Kook, may he live. It's a man of many-sided talents of Torah. Ish Ashkolot, it's an expression for people who have all kinds of different knowledge, and including secular knowledge. Noble traits. Rav Kook didn't have a formal secular education, but he read widely. You'll see the influence of various Western thinkers and Western Jewish thinkers like Buber. We'll see the influence of that later. Also, it's public knowledge that he loathes money. In other words, he doesn't someone who takes bribery. However, his love for Zion surpasses all limits. In other words, he went overboard. Rav Salvejit once said, Rav Kook loves the Jews too much. Right? Anyway, however, right, and he declares the impure pure. That's a very negative thing to say, that the things that it and adduces proof to it. Reminiscent of Rav Meir, compared him to Rav Meir, who accepted the Acher, the Elisha ben Avuya, his heretical teacher, he accepted some elements of him. And therefore, the final halacha did not follow his opinion. Usually we reject Rav Meir, he's in the Mishnah, but half the time we don't follow him. Why? Because he accepted teaching from his Rebbe, who was a heretic. I argued much with him. In other words, Rav Kook, his great crime was a crime of loving too much. What does that mean? That he often said very nice things about Christians, Jesus, secular Jews, sinners, and they would call them not secular Jews, but sinners of Israel. Okay, so he said very nice things about these people, so that means he's got too much love, and it's not enough balance, and we need to do something about it. But the real fear, there's another fear there, not just of being too nice to the secular Zionists, but also, is he saying that also secular studies are good, and then he's going to be the chief rabbi, and then our community here is going to go to shambles, and we're trying to have a community here where we raise all the kids to Torah only, nothing else. It's the same sort of Haredi sort of attitude you encounter today, to some degree. And here's this new rabbi. We know what he is. He looks like the old country, but really, he is he's one of them. He's a maskil, he's a westernizer, and he's going to introduce all kinds of secular studies, and we're going to dilute our whole community. So that was also, so there were problematic theological ideas. There was too much acceptance and praise for what they would view as the wicked secular Zionists. And don't forget, we're talking about not just secular, we're talking about a lot of people who were avowedly anti-religious. The whole approach was to have new Judaism, a new Jew who would just be all about the land of Israel and work and labor, and many of them were communists, etc.
Like Herzl or something.
Yeah, right. We learned in our Shabbos afternoon lectures that when Herzl died, not 3 months after he gets to the chief rabbinate of Herzl dies, right? So he has to give a eulogy for Herzl. So he doesn't mention Herzl by name, but he kind of implies that he's some sort of harbinger of the Messiah, you know, which you know, for those who are listening carefully, say he never even mentioned his name. But for those who are listening even more carefully, would say that he just said that Herzl laid the ground, the physical work, before the spiritual work of the eventual Messiah, and that he praised him. So he was trying to, you know, be respectful and connected to the world he came from, the world of the yeshivas and constant learning and all that. And he remained a Haredi to his dying day. On the other hand, he says, this is not the way. People here are full of scorn for the secular. This is not going to bring them in. We've got to embrace them. And then he used Hasidic and mystical theology to say that we really can embrace them because they really are holy people, because they're all building the land of Israel. And who knows how much holiness is in all kinds of people all around us. So let's take a look at some of his views and let's understand why Svasemis' son had some trouble with it. Torah and science. First thing is Torah and science. Because as I said, that's one of the big issues. Is he going to be a modernizer to change the curriculum in the yeshivas? So he says, who would like to read that for us? Torah and science. Let's start.
At any rate, there is no contradiction whatsoever between the Torah and any of the world's scientific knowledge. We do not have to accept theories as certainties, no matter how widely accepted, for they are like blossoms that fade. Very soon, scientific technology will be further developed, and all of today's new theories will be derided and scorned, and the respective wisdom of our day will be seen small-minded. But the word of God will endure forever. The mountains may depart and the hills be broken, but my faithful love shall never depart from you, nor my covenant of peace be broken, says the Lord, who has mercy on you.
It's a verse. Go on.
The basis of all we teach the world is that everything is the work of God, and the means by which everything is made, whether few or many, even...
No matter what it is, it's all from God. So there's a value in studying things that God made. Anything, science is all about God. It's all about things that God made. But on the other hand, a very healthy dose of skepticism about how long these scientific theories will last, but a sense that there's no contradiction. And anything about, let's say, the age of the universe or things like that, the Torah, as a mystic, he quotes the Zohar, that the essence of the Torah is not about how old the world is. The Torah, all the stories of the Torah, are just the outer garbs for the inner meaning of the Torah. I'm interested in the inner lights of the Torah. Don't tell me about some kind of contradiction with science. Torah is not there for these concrete statements of fact that may contradict science. Torah has much deeper meanings. So that's the crux.
Hey, go. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks on this, science and religion.
Science and religion.
Extraordinary.
Right. Right. But this would come from a more mystical... Right. This also comes from a more mystical place where he's saying that we're only interested in the internal garment, in the internal, anyway. One more paragraph, please, Dr. Levy.
The crux of the matter is that the time of the appearance and the effect of every idea and thought is predetermined. Nothing is haphazard. For example, we can understand that if the fact of the globe's movement was made known to the masses a few thousand years ago, man would have feared to stand on his feet lest he fall from the force of the earth's movement. All the more so we would have feared building tall buildings. A general faint-heartedness and incalculably thwarted development would have resulted. The notion of a gravitational force would not have assured him, having seen with his own eyes that anything standing on the moving object cannot be secure from falling. Only after mankind matured through experience was it proper to allow men to recognize the earth's movement, so that only good would come to man.
Okay, so the number of elements, I'm sorry, you know, I'm just trying to give you little snippets, but the number of elements of his thought that come out of this one paragraph. Number one, the idea that the world wasn't ready for certain ideas. That, in other words, the Torah would put in there something about gravitational force, but if it would say that, then, you know, the ancient people would get worried that they were going to fall off or who knows what. So they weren't ready for it. This relates to the idea of progress. If you read about, let's say, Winston Churchill, people lived in that era, they were very interested in the idea of progress, the notion that the world is progressing in some great fashion and we're moving towards some great thing. Of course, World War I kind of shattered that for a lot of people, and then started to develop a more pessimistic view. But the idea of progress, the notion that the world is progressing in a great... It's reeking out of every line of... it's dripping out of every line of Rav Kook. He believes not only as a messianist, a person who hopes that Mashiach will be coming soon and sees the footsteps in the work of Zionists, but also as someone just very optimistic and Kabbalistic. He believes the world's unfolding, it's a new era. And now this idea of newness and a new era and times have changed, and things are getting better. This is a very dangerous idea. Even recently, there was a big debate in an Orthodox forum, about whether, can the Torah unfold? Because there could be new ideas that are unfolding. Does he believe in a continuing revelation? Are we getting better and smarter? And so there's a very threatening ideas here for some. Some Orthodox, modern Orthodox thinkers, wouldn't have a problem with it. But some people would view this as very dangerous kinds of ideas. The idea of mankind maturing. He thinks men are getting better, right? If he hadn't died in 1935, but had he died in 1945, he may have had a different view of human nature. But we'll see later that he does have a healthy dose of skepticism on the next page about the world, the modern culture. He's going to say all kinds of wonderful things about art and literature and all that, but, and I'm sorry to introduce this to you so early on, this is not the essence of his writings, but now and then it is revealed that, as you could see elements of it in the previous paragraphs, that he is an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and he believes in the supremacy of the Torah over other ideas, and he says that one day the light present civilization will disappear, literature and theater and all that, and all the founded in inanity and in iniquity, and all evil etiquette will pass away, and the entire contemporary civilization is doomed on the ruins. So here, now and then, he acknowledges the supremacy of Torah and the notion that other ideas will fail, but there's also the idea that there's so many beautiful ideas within other anyone who has beautiful ideas, we shouldn't reject it. If there's wisdom, we should take it. There's a lot of beautiful truths and great ideas out there. We'll see later when he talks about religion and Torah and art that he embraces the idea of art. I'm just giving the top paragraph not to reflect his general thinking, but to as a counterbalance here and there. Especially depending on his audience, he would state the more traditional notions of the supremacy of Torah. But nonetheless, he does see some positive things, many positive things all around. So, for instance, Torah and other religions. So, Steve, would you read that for us? Torah and other religions.
Regarding my statement,
and this is a letter that he's writing to a friend. Go ahead.
It was indeed intentional.
Okay, so what's it referring to? Look at footnote 2. Footnote 2 on page 4. Go ahead.
In this weakened situation, Christianity appeared and caused division in the nation. Its founder had a wondrous force of personality, and his spirit's flow was great, but he did not escape the pagan fault, which is the strengthening of the spirit's flow without an ethical and scholarly education. And was so overcome by his flow of spirit, and had his followers also overcome by it, that they lost their Jewish characteristics, and their deeds and spirits became alien from the quarry from which they were hewn.
Right. So at the one hand, right, so maybe a modern person would say, that's terrible, you're calling Christianity pagan, and right? But from the point of view of people he's living with then, they're like, what? You said Jesus had a spiritual flow, and he... it was great, right? So he was accused of praising founder of Christianity. So continue.
But he's not praising the founder of Christianity.
Go ahead.
He's only giving him the benefit of that little doubt.
You know? But he's saying that something.
He wasn't based in scholarship or
right.
in Torah.
But he said that, right. He said, right. But the notion, this is typical of Rav Kook in the sense that he knows that with anybody who founds a religion, there is a spiritual flow there.
Yeah.
Right. So he acknowledges that, because whenever he sees things around him, he sees the positive in it, the positive spark. That's the Kabbalistic idea of the spark. Okay, let's continue.
Okay, continue.
At a time. Before the footnotes. Back to the first line. At a time. The first line. Regarding my statement.
At a time like this, it is incumbent on us to bridge the gap.
Which
is prone from the beginning, and as a result of which it fell under the influence of nations pagan by their very character.
I'm sorry about the flow, but anyway, it fell under the influence of of pagans. Go ahead.
That there are righteous Christians is proven by all accounts by their good works in relation to justice and human righteousness.
So this is an idea which Rabbi Soloveitchik also echoes, that you can work with Christians and Christian leaders for justice, human righteousness. These are things that we have in common. Go ahead.
What connection does this have with the uplifted souls of the pious few? As to the disregard of which you suspect of me, it may justly be said of me, may my lot be that of the innocent suspect.
Right. Anyway, but then the fellow claims that Jews don't do enough research about Judaism. He says, what do you mean? Only people who write in the style of the Gentile scholars are considered wisdom. In other words, in those days, there wasn't that much, let's say, Orthodox scholarship of a sophisticated nature. So they would say, oh, we don't have any good writings about religion. So he says, well, yeah, only if it's written in scholarly German or something, then it's good religion. But if it's written in Hebrew, it doesn't count. You know? Anyway, but he says, on the paragraph on the side, that you turn the pages sideways, were we to penetrate, fourth line, the depths of divine ethical ideas written in our multitude of books. In other words, if we could really get to the depth, that's the orot, the light that's within all the writings of our Torah, right? Not the kind of stuff of like that the average page of the Talmud is about, but the depth of it, then we would not be ashamed to speak to our enemies at the gate. We'd be able to present a complete range of our own religious researches, perhaps more than any other nations. So this is beginning of the idea that maybe we can make a yeshiva or write a book or begin the project of uncovering the true lights that shine forth from the Torah, and then we could create this incredible body of wisdom that we could share with everybody, and everyone, the whole world will be very impressed. And this is the kind of stuff that Mashiach one day will teach. Now, if you're a traditionalist listening to this, what's your objection? Okay, it's unusual to be thinking about proselytizing. It's also, okay, what else? Good. What else? What's objectionable about that? If you could penetrate the depths of divine ethical ideas written in our multitude of books. In other words, everything that's written in our multitude of books is really missing something. It doesn't talk about the depths of it. We need to talk about the depths. This runs into the problem. Go ahead.
We were kind of a mile wide, but an inch deep. We didn't get deep
enough. We didn't get deep enough. Okay, good. But the thing is he disparaging all of our books?
I don't think so.
Go ahead.
Disparaging us.
Because, I mean, it's just like when he said that many people agreed that the stories in the Torah,
right,
that there was an inner depth, and the stories are just the outer clothing.
Well, right.
So we could say that about the Talmud also.
Right, but right. So all you're doing is you're saying that Kabbalistic Zohar passage on which this whole idea is based,
yeah,
that's the source of it. But that idea itself,
right. Zohar passage. I thought it was just a view.
He is saying that, you know, that the kind of books that, you know, that we're not penetrating, like the core essence of what these mitzvahs' purpose are about,
yeah,
the deeper meaning.
Right.
Yeah, so people who don't want to go deeper and just want to read the surface could be offended.
Right, but there's always a question, if Judaism is really about its essence, then what do we need the other stuff for? There's all the sloganism of Judaism is about justice. Okay, forget Judaism, we'll do justice. Judaism is about social this, so we'll do social that, and then we don't need Judaism anymore. There's always this problem. Now again,
go through the clothing before you can get to the end.
Good, right. Of course, none of us would accuse this man of being sort of not interested in the details of Judaism. No one who wrote this book about the different Talmudic teachings would we want to accuse of that?
But that's a misunderstanding of what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. People would say that. They would say that. But I think it's a total misunderstanding of what he is trying to do. He's trying to see both. See that there is the inner
life.
I will to be superficial.
Okay.
You know. So
good. I'll mention that. You can do both. I'll mention that right now, Asher is studying with this Rabbi Rosenzweig at Yeshiva University, who is taking the analytic ideas of Rabbi Soloveitchik, which you could say, okay, the analytical ideas of Rabbi Soloveitchik were very interesting. They got to the essence of what the Talmud was saying on every line. The essence of this debate is really that. But or the right salvation was sort of you still could leave and say, okay, that's very clever, but like, what's the point? And there, Rosenzweig is trying to get, I think, my humble opinion, just from afar, seems another layer of what is the philosophy of Judaism about these matters. So, and so the work of the depth work of the Talmud, just firstly analyzing what are they saying, then getting to like what is the broader point, and sort of making the lens go wider and wider. That depth work, which requires the detailed work of understanding what they're actually saying, is a project which we'll talk about later. He's going to mention that, you know, we need a very long book. He's not going to finish this project. He recognizes that. He's realistic enough to know, although he's very dreamy, he can't finish writing that whole book, but he's going to start. Let's go to the next page.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So many commentaries like Rambam and Rashi and Tosafot.
Oh, no.
I misunderstood something.
Let's say you take a legal question, okay? Then you could have 20 different Jewish opinions about it. The Ritva and the Ramban and the Rashba, all these different opinions. That's very deep in the sense that a lot of different opinions, but what's the essence of it? What's the ethical essence of it? What's the spiritual essence of it? What's the message that everyone can glean from? You know, so that is a different type of work which requires, you know, new books to be written to bring out those essence. Now, so he writes on top of page 5 over here that were he to write a book of philosophy, he would explore the depths of the content of the mind to propose a system explaining why it is that we should not fear the divisions of heretical diatribes. In other words, when he hears heretical diatribes, he doesn't have all the answers yet, but if we could get all the essences, we'd be able to, we wouldn't be afraid of anybody who's atheist. To show how far Rav Kook goes in being able to see the beauty in everything around him, well, there's a lot of atheism around him, because communists tend to be atheists. And a lot of early Zionists are kibbutznikim and communists. And so he says, well, top left sidebar, disbelief must come out of the form of civilization to uproot the memory of God and all the institutions, and upon the desolate ruins will the exalted knowledge build its palace. In other words, when people really start to question God, say, I don't believe in any of this, this is all nonsense. On top of the ruins of that question, that's where you build faith.
Right. Joyous.
That's right. Oh, he's just full of optimism. It's unbelievable. So even in atheism, there's whole articles about it that he even believed atheism is the, it comes from faith. You see, today, we wish we had more atheists. I wish there were more atheists in our congregation. What do I mean? People today, they don't think that much about faith altogether. So it's a question of, you know, what do I do on Saturday? Should I go to this synagogue, that synagogue, this church? That's the question. You know, which ritual should I pick up on? But if people were atheists, then you could argue with them and you could, oh, you're an atheist, well, what, we do believe in God. We could have a real discussion about God. But today, we live in sort of a post-philosophical world. Nobody even those who leave Judaism, they're not even leaving for philosophical reasons. They're not even atheists, right? You can't even call them a heretic. They're just usually more hedonistic than atheistic. So with a hedonist, it's hard to have a real conversation. But with an atheist, you can talk. So this is just shows you some of the depth of his willingness to see the sparks of holiness, Kabbalistic idea, in everything. His idea of a yeshiva, if you look on in the top bar on the right, sidebar, Lenny, would you read that for us? To sum up,
the establishment of a yeshiva in the Holy Land, small in number of students for the time being, and nearly unnoticeable in its structure for the study of the inner Torah. In addition to the preparation needed in order to broaden knowledge and enlighten life.
Maybe an allusion to maybe some secular studies would be studied there. In fact, in the Merkaz Harav, I don't know that any secular studies were ever studied. But anyway, he alludes to it. Go ahead.
This matter is the gateway of hope for Israel on the level and the fundamental value of the idea of the love of Zion in all its aspects, which in its entire scope brings us great visions, especially to those like us who stand on the land of our fathers. Most likely this marginal beginning really ought not be in Jerusalem.
No. Anyway, I thought he said it was in Jerusalem. But anyway, Yes. Yeah, so he realized there aren't that many yeshiva students, you know, in those days there weren't that many. Rav Natta was there not too long after this, and you know, he says, you know, how few students there were in the whole world who were studying Torah. So he couldn't really envision a huge yeshiva. But his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, did have a yeshiva that grew to some great numbers. And today, there are most religious Zionists and the West Bank settlers and things like that, Yudan Sharmon, they tend to be students of Rav Kook. And Rav Kook is the most popular rabbi in Israel, and his writings take a lot of time in certain types of yeshivas of Zionist Jews. In any event, couple of things here where there's a little dot on the side. It says, in the third paragraph on the page, it says, it must be not only the body of moral literature, or research, or philosophy, or Kabbalah, each single faceted, but rather a raising of the value and the broadening of knowledge of Jewish and human thought. That's human thought. So he's including non-Jewish thought. From its deepest roots, ascending beyond all the ideas of the world, beating out a strong hand all the doctrines and religions. So you got to take other religions into consideration. Their principal roots, the roots of other religions, ramifications and pathways, confidently scanning all their essences and purposes. He wants to take all the religions and get their essences and purposes, and putting them all into an ordered hierarchical system until it finds a cumulative partsuf, a face of mankind, the book of Adam. This is some sort of mystical allusion to partsufim, the idea that the human being could be an ultimate reflection of God. If we could get all the knowledge and explore and excavate all the great ideas from all the great books and Jewish books and everything else, we could... Esteline, do you want to turn the air conditioning up? Feel free. Just press the up button. To move it to 75. Or if we think we could turn it off, we could turn it off. Okay, so we could create the ultimate human being. And this is the Torah of the Mashiach. In other words, what Torah will the Mashiach teach? A Torah gleaned from the essences of all human knowledge and exploration and everything else. Very exciting kind of an idea. And what he's saying is that I'm starting with a little yeshiva. It's not going to be a big thing, but it's the beginning. Appropriate that it's in Israel. And with these orot and these lights, we will, you know, change the world.
Is still there?
Yes, the America's a Rabbi Yeshiva, yes. Unfortunately, the only day I went there, I went to celebrate Purim. It was supposed to be very lively, but his son died that day. So it was very, it turned into a sad day. But anyway. And then a few years ago, there was a massacre there. But in any event, they should agree to institute the study of all that, the bottom of page 5, pertains to conceptions and thought in the Torah in all its breadth, combined with the education and guidance for healthy body and spirit. Rav Kook was a believer that if the Jews of that time were workers, and they all wore shorts and short sleeves and everything, and showed off their muscles and everything, because they were the new Jew, not the bent-over Jew, but they were the, you know, well-fashioned Jew, and the strong Jew, and the military Jew, and all that. He says, great! We've spent a lot of time on the Jewish spirit. Now we got to build up the Jewish body. So in an ideal yeshiva, you'd build up the Jewish body and the Jewish spirit, and et cetera, et cetera. In all its broad and far-reaching branches of wisdom. So he's not right. Did his son have an education like that? I don't think he actually. In other words, if he actually had a yeshiva, I don't know how many secular studies they would study. But in theory, this was his idea. So I can't tell.
Ideal.
Yeah, I don't know whether he meant this for the outside or the inside. Anyway, I don't think it quite came out that way.
Okay,
it's misleading.
And they also learn in colleges.
They're not Hezder. In other words,
right.
I come from the world of Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Shalom's yeshiva, the Hezder yeshiva, in which people say, well, we should learn Torah while we go to the army.
Yeah.
The Merkaz Rav Kook people, they go a little bit more toward the Haredim in that they study first, and then they go to the army for a shorter time. So they go to the army, but they go after they study, which in Israel's in a hierarchy of modernity is considered sort of less modern because they're in the army less. But in any event, they're not in the Haredi world. They do go to the army. But moving along, then will our children see our might and our glory. You know, if we could expose them to all the wisdoms together, our truth and our spiritual richness, and by their page six, by their spirits will be refined and uplifted, and they will be heartened to be exalted in the strength of our people. Beautiful discussion, description of this great Torah. Let's see, who would like to read? Nancy, would you read the entire world?
The entire world has only the garb and shell of spirituality.
Kabbalistic expression, that they just have the outside, but they need to get to the inside. Go ahead.
For paganism is no more than a shell enclosing a small and dark interior.
Right.
And the religions which tried to make pagan nations into upholders of Jewish ethics, sanctified in a feeling of divine holiness.
Who's he talking about? Christians. Go on.
Could not change the essence of the pagan character fixed in the assemblies of all human social groups.
Right. So, on the one hand, there's almost a hint of the idea that even the pagans, you could find you could find something within the pagans. Anyway, but he realized that the Christianity are trying to give a feeling of divine holiness. They're trying. So there's an acknowledgement of other religions there, even in this paragraph that's kind of very anti-pagan and anti-Christian to some degree.
You're right, like this. You'd be afraid of them.
Afraid of Christians?
No,
he's in Israel. There are very few Christians. Muslim, mostly Muslim.
Can you say one more time? I know you said this. I don't remember. Why did he consider Christians to be pagans?
Oh, that's a general discussion. We have a different class about that. There's a general idea that Christianity, since it's not complete monotheism, in that if we don't accept the Trinity as one or whatever, then it turns out that they have the idea of a son, a father and a son, if not the Holy Ghost as well, then it turns out that they're sort of pagan. But here in this paragraph, he's saying that Christianity tried to put itself as a layer over the paganism of the people, but they couldn't fully succeed because there's too much paganism at the root of it all. Okay, a little more about sparks of holiness. Now, the background of this paragraph is that generally we associate Rav Kook with the idea mentioned in the critical paragraph of the Sfat Emes' son, the Imre Emes' paragraph at the beginning of our discussion, that Rav Kook loved the secular too much. In other words, he praised the secular as if they're, like for instance, Herzl is the harbinger, is the precursor of the Mashiach in some way. He's praising the secular too much, so he says over here something that's sort of you don't know what to believe about it. But he claims that he's selective in who he loves. Let's continue. Charles, want to read that for us? Sparks of Holiness. Page 6 in the middle.
And the Lord bless me, He knows that I do not befriend all transgressors.
In other words, it's true, I befriend many transgressors, but I don't befriend all the transgressors.
But only those that I feel have a great power of segula within them.
They have that spark, they have that... Go ahead.
There are many ways to attain this knowledge, and many lengthy books need to be written in order to explain just a little of this great thing. And of those who have already totally lost even their inner segula, King David, may rest in peace, said, "Do I not hate, O Lord, those who hate thee?"
So he waxes traditional. There's an idea that if you could define someone as wicked, which Chazon Ish, who was the head of the Haredi community in Bnei Brak, said that, well, today no one's really wicked, but if you could find someone who's really wicked, then after all, there's a verse that says, God, those who hate you, I hate. So he says, well, count me in. I'm in that too. But, of course, he spent most of his time loving all Jews in Israel, including those who were, very, very avowedly secular and transgressing all kinds of things. Go ahead.
Right.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. It is.
I wonder if he's trying to separate. He's trying to separate himself from being the first Ashkenazic. He's trying to bring some legitimacy to the Ashkenazic.
Oh, no. His main detractors are not so Sephardic. They're just the Haredi Ashkenazi.
Okay.
Go ahead.
They just passed down to us general signs for this. In most cases, the minute.
It's a type of heretics.
And heretics have lost even their inner segula, and this is what happens in most generations. But the generation of the approaching footsteps of the Messiah is an exception to this.
So in other words, usually Christians and everybody else and sinners don't have any sparks of holiness in them at all. But as you get closer to Mashiach, even the unholy people have holier sparks. Go ahead.
Footsteps of the Messiah is an exception for this rule, for they are, in the words of the Tikkun Zohar, good on the inside and bad on the outside.
That's the essence of his thinking about secular Zionists and even about Christians, is that they're good on the inside, they're just bad on the outside. Go ahead.
For they are the donkey of Messiah.
Now, what is it? So we all know that Messiah is supposed to come on a donkey. Unless we merit, he'll come on the clouds. But there's an idea of ani rochev achmo, a poor man coming on a donkey. What does that mean?
About which the verse says, behold, the king comes to you, lowly and riding on a donkey. And the meaning is like a donkey who has two external marks of impurity, so that its impurity is more noticeable.
But so in other words, he's sending on a donkey, meaning in the days of Messiah, there'll be the messianic spark will be inside, and the people will be riding on a donkey. They'll look like a donkey on the outside, but really on the inside, there'll be a lot of holiness. So in the end of days, the sparks are coming out like crazy, and there's a lot of dross on the outside that's distracting us, but he's seeing deeper in there. This next paragraph is from the Arpalei Torah, which I think is considered a more radical book, and look what he says about how the secular and religious Jews should team up together. Sam, did you get a chance to read?
What page?
Page 6 at the bottom.
Israel should bond together, and the nefesh of the observant will be corrected by the perfection of nefesh of the better transgressors.
Says, wait a second, how can a religious Jew be perfected by a non-religious Jew? You know how? In regard to communal affairs. Now, it's in the relation, being able to relate to the broader world. Go ahead.
A material and spiritual ideas attain to human understanding and perception.
Right, in other words, the religious are lacking in their material and spiritual ideals. They're lacking in their attainment of human understanding. And now they have Torah knowledge, but not human knowledge. Go ahead.
Whereas the ruach
yes.
of this transgression will be corrected by the influence of the God-fearing.
We have a great partnership. The religious will influence the non-religious. Go ahead.
Observant and great of faith. And thereby both groups will receive great light.
Right.
The higher...
Right, so et cetera, et cetera. So, in other words, the secular have a very important role to play in sort of educating and edifying. We more religious types, supposedly more religious, we're lacking in a lot of areas. We can be helped by the others.
They
need each other. Yeah. So that's what in other words, he's looking at this world and he's saying, look, this is redemption is coming. And he says to himself, what's going on here? Why is redemption happening with all these secular people? He says, oh, I understand. The guy in the yeshiva who's throwing dirty diapers at me. He's not ready to go build the land and create a revival of the Jewish state. He can't do that. So he's going to learn yeshiva and do his thing, which is great. That's the spirit of the people. But in the meantime, the secular kibbutzim who thinks he's so secular and he's against Judaism and all that nonsense. He's really the building the body of Israel, and together it's going to great things, and everything's going to work out great. Now, later on, the secular Jews got wind of this philosophy, which imbues many religious Jews today, and said, wait a second, are you saying that, like, in the end we all become religious or something? We're not interested in that. Are you saying that really, I'm not what you think I am? I say I'm secular, really I'm this holy Jew. You know, don't tell me what I am. So there's a lot of negative, what do they call it, not feedback, but kickback, pushback, from this type of philosophy, and you know, how do you sell this to the secular? It may sound very nice to us. Oh, that wonderful! He's so embracing of everybody, but there's this negative feedback from the secular who is saying, "No, I am what you think I am, what I appear to be. I am a secular Jew. Don't accept me because you say I'm really a holy Jew. I am a secular Jew." Anyway, so it's interesting how the repercussion. You know, even this idea is so beautiful, didn't always fly. Then he had a problem. I don't think in this book here, about selected letters. I don't know the exact circumstances, whether they asked him or he wrote it to them, whether it was solicited, but the question came up. They wanted to start the Bezalel Art School. So he wrote them a letter. Now, you would think that a rabbi would say, well, you can't make any graven images, and you can't, you know, and besides, don't waste your time on drawing nonsense. And that's what you'd expect. So he wanted to share with them his view, his broader view on art, and try to give them encouragement. And also, as a chief rabbi, they're trying to tell them, you know, there are certain things that are verboten, and, you know, if this is going to be a Jewish state of some sort, so I don't care whether you're religious or not religious, if we could stick to certain rules, this could be a Jewish art school. If we're a truly Jewish art school, and there'd be a revival of Jewish appreciation of beauty in a new homeland, but it would be Jewish art. Unfortunately, they didn't listen to him. But let's see what they say. Shirley?
The higher it said he came...
No. Oh, we're skipping. Skipping to page 7. Just the next page.
Okay. Our nation has always related in a positive and pleasant way to the artistic beauty manifest in the creative works made with human hands, but our respect for art is also limited.
Is that your impression of Judaism? That it has great respect for the beautiful? And artistic, beautiful, made by human hands?
Sure.
Okay.
Look at the Mishkan, just one example.
Good.
And our sanctuary.
Our sanctuary? Good. Good. But give me a counterexample.
Counterexample?
Golden calf.
Compared to Christianity or Catholicism, you know, they've got many more images.
Right.
Deities and so
right. 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 So we don't have images. Okay, so let's see. But he says, but there's a limit. The halakha often says, go ahead, do whatever you want to do. But, you know, have a nice steak, but you got to slur it this way, you got to do that, and don't eat this. So there's often the limits. Go ahead.
Indeed, the limit of those things which are inherently good and ennobled is small, soft, delicate and beautiful.
Set about
with roses.
No, don't get scared. I'm not going to tell you any big rules. It's just going to be a small rule. Go ahead.
Even through a hedge of roses, they make no breach. For the nation of Israel, even a hedge of roses is sufficient.
This is an allusion to the idea that the Jewish people are compared to a hedge of roses, that we make certain rules so that men and women shouldn't have certain encounters with each other, and it could just be a hedge of roses. It doesn't have to be a complete thorn bush. It could be a hedge of even with a hedge of roses, we avoid certain forbidden things. Go ahead.
Or one distinct line, even one red thread, one symbolic stroke that carries upon it the mark of the noble idea.
So here comes my restriction, right? So it's a beautiful way of introducing. I'm about to tell you what you can't do. Go ahead.
When our nation came into being, it found mankind wrapped in the swaddling cloth of its wild infancy and the wild sense of beauty which lacked purity and tenderness conquering the world. And beauty itself was likely to become, in the hands of the crude masses, a sort of cheap pastry and intoxicating drink, were unable to suckle from the glory of ethical and knowledgeable truth. Paganism, with all its abominations, laid its dirty and blood-soaked hands on this delicate flower, beauty and fine art, and practically separated it from its purity.
If you look at some modern art, if you look at some pagan art, You see what he's talking about. It's some of it's not so holy. But this is terrible because we want things that are beautiful. We love artistic beauty, even things created by the human hand. So, but it's just the pagans messed it all up. Go ahead.
The whole realm of adornment, ornamentation, beautification, and painting is permitted to Jews. There is only one limit, one mark, seemingly very long, but distinguishing its quality and not its quantity. This limit conveys much spirituality, but does only minimal harm to craftsmanship and art for all the power of its noble purpose. All visages are allowed, save the face of man.
That's some sort of rabbinic quote, citation.
Okay. In fact, only the sculpture of a complete human face is prohibited. And there are ways of understanding by which even this prohibition may be circumvented, such as through the help of a Gentile assistant in the final stage of the prohibited sculpture.
So he was hoping he could put a hechsher, a rabbinic supervision on the art school, and there would be a Jewish art school, and they'd have sculpture and everything. They'd have all kinds of art, and he just gave one restriction. Now, there are actually other things. You're not supposed to draw certain heavenly images, etc. Anyway, but somehow he was able to boil it down to one restriction. But anyway, they didn't listen to him. Just the face. He sculpture a three-dimensional human face. That's what he was against. There are those who say you also can't draw like things in the heavens. Yes?
A Shabbos
goy. Right? Anyway.
Any man's nice?
Okay. Any man, right. Anyway, and then just an interesting side, it was too good not to mention, the goal, and another, just a side note, the goal of education.
It's a complete human face. I mean,
right.
It has to be extremely...
Right.
So most of it is really...
If you can make it more impressionistic, if you can make a face...
But nobody can really do a complete human face exactly. So really, he says that, you know...
It's an argument.
It's prohibited. So really...
I mean, since there are no teeth...
It's not that
Judaism wasn't used to it because
I think if you had a complete face, eyes and ears, nose and face, it would be a face. You could try to leave something out. Yeah.
Didn't they used to prohibit photographs and stuff?
Right, he's saying that's fine. Right. Just three dimensional. Anyway, let's skip. This is a nice paragraph about what the purpose of education is. Very important thing. We've forgotten what the purpose of education is, namely, to teach righteousness and goodness. And what's the difference between a secular education and a Jewish education? Because we're also interested in teaching righteousness and goodness, and calling the name of God. But anyway, let's get to some key readings, and with that we will conclude. I asked my good friend Rabbi Avi Goldberg in Israel, who loves to study Rav Kook, what would be some great passages to read. He said these two things, so we're going to take him for we're going to do that. And with that, we will conclude. So here's to get a feeling. Till now, we saw snippets. But now we want to get a feeling of Rav Kook's writing. You know, last week, we talked about the Sfat Emet, that it was accessible to all. Rav Kook takes a lot of work. Many Israeli religious Jews, become very accustomed to his writings. I once took a whole course on, I think it was on this book, Musar Avicha. And, it was a very dense course of trying to unpack different paragraphs. Anyway, in that spirit, let's read that. Okay. Who would like to read this for us? Let's see. Esteline. Go ahead.
The land of Israel is not something external, not an external national asset, and means to the end of collective solidarity and the strengthening of the nation's existence, physical or even spiritual.
No, some Zionists would say that it's just there to help us unite. No, that's not enough. Go ahead.
The land of Israel is an essential unit bound by the bond of life to the people, united by inner characteristics to its existence.
The Jew and the idea that the Jew and the land are one. Go ahead.
Therefore, it is impossible to appreciate the content of the sanctity of the land of Israel and to actualize the depth of love for her by some rational humanist.
Okay. I'm sorry. I feel isn't tight.
Only by the Spirit of God that is in the soul of Israel. The Spirit radiates natural hues in all avenues of healthy feeling and shines according to the measure of supernal Holy Spirit, which fills with life and pleasantness the heart of the holy of thought and deep Jewish thinkers. The view of the land of Israel is only an external value serving as a cohesive force, even when it comes only to reinforce the Jewish idea in the diaspora, to preserve its identity and to strengthen faith, fear of God, and observance of mitzvot, commandments, bears no permanent fruit, for this foundation is shaky compared to the holy might of the land of Israel.
Don't make Israel into an instrument for something else, for doing more mitzvot, for keeping us together. That's all nonsense. It loses the essence, the essence of the light of it. It's the holy might of the land of Israel. Go ahead.
The true strengthening of the Jewish idea in exile will come about only through the depth of its immersion in the land of Israel. Oh. And from the hope of the land of Israel, it will receive always its essential characteristics. The expectation of salvation is a force that preserves exilic Judaism. The Judaism of the land of Israel is salvation itself.
Ah, okay. So outside of Israel, what preserves us is the expectation of going to Israel. And in the land of Israel, the Judaism of the land of Israel is salvation. So, in other words, you're there. When you're doing Torah in Israel, you are there. Okay, you're doing such a great job, Sheldon. Would you continue?
Distance from awareness of the mysteries produces a distorted awareness of the sanctity of the land of Israel. Due to alienation from the secret of God, the higher qualities of the depths of godly life are reduced to trivia that do not penetrate the depth of the soul.
We've got to get more mystical, more depth, more overwrought, more sparks, more lights. Go on.
When this happens, the most mighty force is missing from the soul of nation and individual, and galut, exile, finds favor essentially. To one who grasps only the outer surface, nothing fundamental is lost with the loss of land sovereignty and all the ingredients of an intact nation. For such a person, the expectation of salvation is but a branch that never connects to the depth of Jewish awareness. This itself attests to the lack of understanding in such a lifeless approach. We do not negate any conception based on rectitude and awe of heaven of any form. Only the aspect of such an approach that desires to negate the mysteries and the great influence on the spirit of the nation. This is a tragedy that we must combat with counsel and understanding, with holiness and courage.
So there's something mystical about the our connection to the land of Israel that connects a Jew with the land, which we cannot describe, and it's something beyond, it's not an instrument of something else. And you know, so it's interesting. You know, he's the great supporter of the modern Zionist, but in many ways, this is being more Zionist than the Zionist because loves the land so much. But on the other hand, is critical of viewing Israel as some kind of instrument towards something else. Such a, in Zionist conception, it holds us together and it brings us together and it saves us from the Gentile attackers and it unites us, and for the religious Jew, it's a place where you can do mitzvos. And although he says all that's missing the essence, and if you're missing the essence, then you might as well be in exile. you're still in exile. The essence of being in Israel is getting all those essences. When you come to Israel, your Judaism explodes, and all the essences should come out, and that's what he hopes.
Is he saying that the land wasn't made for us; we were made for the land?
That's good.
Is that really what he's getting at?
That's good. That's a good terse way of saying it. Interesting.
What did you say? I'm sorry, John.
We look at Israel as something we can use for our, and I think he's saying that the land was not made just for us. We were made for the land.
Okay. There's something essential in our soul that connects with the land of Israel.
We can't be separated from it. Right. There's no. We only like it if we can use it. It doesn't work. And that's a lot of Jews feel that way. This is their connection. It's a
mystical connection.
Yeah, it's very difficult to. If you've been there, which all of you have, I'm sure. It doesn't. You have to be there to feel it. You can't tell people about it.
There's a third component with the land of Israel, the people of Israel, and the Torah of Israel. Yes. That it's all one. And in any event, hopefully you get a little feeling of his dreaminess and his beautiful language. And now something else where he talks about the eye. And again, our salvation talks about the eye. Buber talks about the eye. He's talking about the eye. Anyway. The true I, the true self. So, let's read that, and with that we will conclude. So, next page, page 9. It's a page that looks like this. It's a Hebrew-English page. We're doing a little more close reading, so I left the actual Hebrew here. Okay, now let's see. Nancy, are we back to you again?
And I am in the exile, the internal I. The I of the individual and of the congregation is not revealed in its innermost sense, only according to its holiness and purity.
So you're never going to get to your true I unless you get involved in holiness and purity.
Its holiness and purity according to the value of its higher power, which is absorbed from its pure light of the splendor of above, which burns in his inner.
So you get to the true the true I, you get to from the holiness and purity, according to the value of the holiest and purity, to the extent that it comes from the divine greatness above, and that greatness is drenched with a Holy Spirit from above. Go ahead.
We sinned with our ancestors, the sin of Adam the first, who became estranged from his essence, who turned his mind to the snake and lost himself, did not know how to respond with a clear answer to the question, how?
Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say how, it's the Ayeka. Who, where are you? Where are you? Because he very good. He lost who he was. Where are you? I don't know. He didn't know. He lost his essence. Yeah. Good.
He turned his mind to the snake?
In other words, the snake said, eat from the fruit. So he said, okay, fine.
I thought that went through Eve.
Right. It's interesting. He chose not to
Adam's
blame
first.
It on Eve. Right. Generally, you talk about original sin. It's Eve who does original sin.
Yeah.
It's interesting. In this paragraph, he just talks about man. Whether there's in general, you know, as I said, he's not a completely modern man. He was against women's suffrage. But, so I don't know enough about his feminist views in general. But in any event, it is interesting in this paragraph where he doesn't dump it on Eve. But in any event, go ahead.
Because he didn't know his soul, because his true I-ness was lost from him. With the sin of the bowing to a foreign god...
It should be bowing. Bowing, did I misspell it? Go ahead.
With the sin of bowing to a foreign god, Israel sinned after the foreign gods.
So there's the personal sin, original sin, which is Adam and Eve, and then there's the national original sin, which is the golden calf, which is also like the national original sin. So he's talking about both. Go ahead.
His I-ness essence he abandoned. Israel forsook the good. She weakened her essence, went after purposes and goals, did not give her whole strength, which was meant to be one whose tree is not like the taste of its fruit.
This is an allusion to the Rashi, the Midrash, that says that, you know, originally every tree was supposed to give forth the fruit. So you could take a piece of the apple tree for lunch and you would eat it and it would be delicious. But instead, the tree is a garnish. It has little purpose for most of us. You can build something out of it. And the fruit, all we can eat is the fruit. But somehow the world got corrupted and all we can eat is the fruit instead of the tree. So he says, let's see, it weakened our essence and then we weren't able to get to the to our full strength, which comes from a world in which there's no dross, and there's no a world in which the tree would be like the fruit. Go ahead.
Cast her eyes outside of her to think about goals and careers.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't translate the next phrase. I'm not sure. The moon did something. Go ahead.
The moon criticized.
I'm not sure. That's probably the wrong translation. But go on.
The midrash, the moon.
Uh huh. Oh, okay. Oh, good. Very good. You got it. She got it. There's an allusion to the Rashi that when the moon said, "Hey, you know, God, I'm as big as the sun, and the sun is as big as the sun, so you know, you really can't have two kings." So when she sinned that way, the moon is a reflection of Israel, and Israel sinned because somehow it wanted to be like the sun or something. Anyway, then at that point, what happened?
The moon criticized. It lost its inner orbit, its joy in its lot. It dreamt about the glory of an outside king, and so the world goes. And
that alludes to Lenny's midrash that the outside king was hoping to say, "Hey, who gets to be king here?" You know, God is king. You don't need any other king. Go ahead.
So the world goes and drowns with the loss of the eye of every person. Great educators...
Of the individual and the nation.
Oh, of the individual and the nation. Great educators...
Okay, so there was the sin of the individual. That was Adam. So he lost the personal eye. And then the nation lost their personal eye with the golden calf.
Great educators come and look at externals and ignore also the eye, and they add straw to the fire. They water the plants with vinegar. They fatten the brains and the hearts with all that all that which is outside them. And the I is continually lost, and since there is no I, there is no him, and certainly there is no you.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. Anybody want to take a shot at that? There's no me, there's no him, and there's certainly no you. You probably with a capital Y. There's no you. You can't reach out to God in an I thou relationship. Right now, Buber, I think wrote. I'd have to figure out who's came first here. I don't know. That could be after Buber. Yeah, Buber probably came first.
If there's no I, then the him is the same person. And there's no, that person isn't a person.
Right.
And then if there's no person, if God has no people, then he can't be a God to anybody. He's got to be a God to somebody.
Well, then, is he saying there's no you with a capital U?
If you're not my people.
Right, then what? He's not the leader, he's not the king. Yeah. We're working on it. Anyway, continue, please.
The breath of our nose.
Hey, nostrils. It's an expression from. Go ahead, the breath.
The anointed one of God. This is his.
Anointed one, Mashiach. Go ahead.
It is not outside of us. It is our breath of our nose. Hashem, our God, and David, our King, we seek.
In other words, when we say that we're seeking Mashiach, which is the breath, which we call the breath of our nostrils, we're really, that's the great glory. In other words, the other people try to give us some kind of glory, they educate us with vinegar, and that doesn't work. But losing your inner orbit. But the real, what we really seek, what a Jew really longs for is Mashiach. And we explained before what Mashiach is. It's the coming together of all human knowledge to the point where you get to the godly, divine knowledge, and the human being becomes a true reflection of God, the way he's supposed to be, because you have all the collective human knowledge, you know, right? So, but instead, they give us other stuff. The educators give us other stuff. Go ahead.
To Hashem and to His goodness we rear.
Wait a second. Fear. Oh, sorry.
Fear.
We fear. Yeah.
The eye we seek, ourselves we seek, and we find. Remove all the foreign and bastard eyes, and you will know that I am Hashem, your God, who takes you out of Egypt to be for you, God, I am.
Now, why would such a magnificent writer, why would he launch into a verse at the end? He's just quoting the verse. What's the value? There has to be a value in quoting the whole verse. Otherwise, you would just quote, all he needs, after all, is just, I am God. What does he need the part about Egypt?
Because he's reminding us that that's why he took us out of Egypt and we have.
But he's not writing to people from Egypt. He's writing to people living in Israel.
I know, but you have to.
What's Egypt? What's the Egypt? What's the Egypt of his day? It's all the foreign ambassadors, the czar umamzer, right? All the foreign stuff, right? The all these isms, you know, communism and socialism and all the Western ideas that Jews brought to Israel. They have some sparks of good ideas there, but it's not going to get us to light up our inner essence.
God will bring us out of that, like he brought us out of Egypt.
You get out of it, right. Understanding that when we got out of Egypt, we also took the sparks out of Egypt, so surely we'll take the sparks out of the isms and all that, but we've got to get out of that. So
Maybe it's also...
Sorry?
Those are today's Egypt.
Yes. Now...
But would I say something? Maybe it's the ideas of the educators, though, that are very external, that are the things that he is trying to say is the Egypt.
The Egypt, right. Well, isn't that interesting, right? Because one of the things they're worrying, right, the Haredim, the old issue of the old settlement, what they're worried about is he's coming and he's going to modernize too much and he's going to open the schools to all kinds of secular education, which was exactly what they were running away from. And his Rebbe, the Netziv, allegedly, you know, closed the yeshiva when they said, well, you'll just, you know, you'll teach Russian half a day, then you can study some Talmud. He said, forget it. There are all kinds of versions of that story, but there's an image that he comes from a world where they, you know, where the Goyim were making a study, secular studies, and he's the one. And yet here, you see him criticizing the modern education.
I think he is, though. Oh, he wrote the modern
education. Modern education.
He's saying the ones, because not that they're teaching secular
right,
subjects,
of course.
They're looking only at the external.
Right.
and they are not, you know, they're not like helping people to look within their own soul.
Right. Now we can go back to that education. What is education? You think education, folks, go back to the page 7 there. He says, primary goal was preparation of man for struggle with existence, right? Oh, I can't go to yeshiva, I have to prepare for my career. While the search for good and righteousness, and all the more the calling of the name of God, was considered secondary to mundane life and its struggles. That has penetrated us. And as we start to view education as just to struggle for existence. But to our sorrow, there's a great many who have forgotten our essential form of education, removed from their schools the primacy of the goal of righteousness and the good. So, you know, he's fighting the more secular at the same time that he's advocating for something more secular. but for him, there wouldn't be a secular education. There would be a science class that would appreciate the godly nature all around us. There would be a history class where you'd learn the beauty of God in history. There'd be an English class where, in Lichtenstein's view, you would explore the depths of a human personality, and etc.
The statement that confused me is that this is on page 5. So all the intellectual heresies, just that aspect of imagination, must come to an end and disappear. Then he says, but the good thing that it causes in the world must be left established.
Where is that?
It's on.
But that's only the end.
At the end,
all the intellectual heresies
is doomed, and on its ruins will be established.
On page 5, all the intellectual heresies.
Oh, well, yeah. Page 5. I'm sorry, where are you? Show me pointing. All the intellectual heresies deal only with the aspect of imagination that is found naturally connected to the feelings of faith, and this aspect of imagination must come to an end.
It disappear. I mean, it just. Is he appeasing these other people? And then he says, but the good thing that it causes must be left established.
Right, because
the word heresies bothered me a lot right there. The first time we read it, I didn't really quite get what he was talking about.
He's a very courageous man.
How do you understand, translate that sentence for us?
It seems to me he's saying all this other stuff, this secular stuff, has got to disappear. But there's some good in it that can be left over after it disappears.
Right, right.
So he's kind of maybe appeasing these people. But the courage this man showed is incredible. But he's taking on his whole establishment.
Right. Right. Yes. Well, he's taking on everybody. Right. There's nobody who's in his camp. He's taking on the old yeshuv, and he's also taking on the new settlers.
So everyone is in his camp, and everyone is not in his camp.
Right. He's
at the same camp.
Right. There's no camp. Right. No, he. And what's very impressive is that if you believe what he writes, and some of the writers I think believe this also, that he really tried to sort of give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, there are certain things he thought went overboard, but he recognized, oh, all the people who criticize me, they're really very holy, and it seems like he let it sort of slide off his back. He remained optimistic. It didn't make him bitter. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems that on the interpersonal level, he was able to walk the walk. That, in other words, if he's so loving everybody, what about the people whose students are literally throwing garbage at him? So what about them? So, I don't know, I get a feeling that he was able to live with all this tension, and he just still kept loving everybody, but requires further investigation. But in any event, I hope you get the idea of a man who is ready to sort of bring in everything, the theory of everything, you know, to bring everything in to the orbit of the holy, and to select out the dross, the things that don't belong, that don't edify, that don't inspire. And but at the same time, there are limits. There are certain things that are forbidden in the art school. There are certain things that don't have a place. But he goes pretty far in terms of what things could, you know, have something good about them, even as far as atheism, Christianity, Jesus. At the same time, can't accuse him of being an atheist or a Christian or or a secularist or even a Zionist. He can't even go, to say that he was a Zionist, that's not a word he would use. Like to say Rav Soloveitchik was modern Orthodox, he didn't use that expression. To say Rav Kook was a Zionist, well, he supported the Zionist movement, but he would not say he was, I don't think that word was, because the Zionists were secular. So that was a different idea that other religious Zionists came up with, was that you could be a religious Zionist. But his idea was that Zionism has a lot of holy things, but I don't think he called himself, if I'm not mistaken, didn't call himself a Zionist. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
On behalf of the Adult Education Committee, I want to thank everyone for coming to this most interesting class tonight, and we look forward to next week's class. Now, next week is the Tuesday night.
That's right. Next week we'll be on Tuesday. That's absolutely right. Yeah, next week there's a graduation here at the school, so we have to...
And so whom are we covering next week? Heschel.
Next week is Abraham Joshua Heschel, also a very very dreamy thinker, and very similar. All these first three are very similar, and the final week, we'll go back to Wednesday on the final week, and now, you'll have to bear with me. Yeah, well... We'll try to get here at 8:20 next time. The final session, I think, we'll just make it for 8:30. But the next session, should be able to do 8:20, hopefully.
I think so. It was when it's meant.
It depends on how
I've never seen.
How soon you get a minion for a
right. No, I'll try to muster up some more minions so we can get it done. If anybody wants to join us earlier, that would be good.
Yeah, ideally.
I've never seen a 30-minute.
It can be done. It can be done.
I've never seen
it. Tonight we did in 20 minutes. Anyway, God willing.
Thank you,
okay, thank you all for joining us. Appreciate it. Nice to see everybody.